William Morrow and Harper Audio present Dead to Her, a novel by Sarah Pinbrough, performed by Saskia Merleveld. Part 1. Hell is empty, and all the devils are here. The Tempest. 1. The candle burns. Crisp paper. A pen. What happened to Johnny? Envelope. Seal. Whisper. Wait. 2. You can't tame a wild thing. The thought bubbled up from someplace deep inside Marcy, a ripple in the stagnant water that had become her life. She could feel Eleanor's appraising eyes on the guests, looking down from the gilt-framed portrait that still hung on the staircase wall, overshadowing them all. Dead less than a year. What would she make of this turn of events? A hubbub of quietly spoken comments from the tight circle of people among whom Marcy stood fluttered in the warm air. Elsewhere, the tension of repressed snickers and sideways glances.
Well, my, will you look at that.
The old dog.
Has he lost weight? Sure doesn't look like a man ready to retire. I didn't know what I was expecting, but she is something else.
And so young. She was young, this newcomer among them, this second Mrs. William Radford IV. What, 22? Younger? 23 at the most. Eleanor had been 40 years older than that when she died.
There's no fool like an old fool.
Iris, ever dry, Eleanor's close friend since they'd been young together a different world ago. It was Iris who'd done her best to keep Eleanor the elegant Savannah Belle she'd long been, even when the cancer had ravaged her to skeletal. By the end, her makeup was so thick, Marcy had thought Eleanor looked like Baby Jane. But what could she say? She'd said the same as everyone else did. My, you're looking so well, Eleanor, always so lovely. Can I fetch you a sweet tea? This new wife, though, this black second wife, was ravishing, not ravaged. Her skin shone with health and strength. She was sleek and proud, with strong, slim limbs and perfect curves at hip and bust. Hair, straightened and glossy, was pulled back tight. A small belly that promised a steak indulgence rather than a rabbit salad. The kind of belly men loved in women and women hated in themselves. She came down the sweeping stairway smiling, with her chin held high, eyes alight with pride, as if the man on her arm were a handsome movie star, not a 65-year-old with vein purple cheeks, who may have lost some weight, but on whom years of indulgence had taken their toll. William Radford IV was the epitome of indulged. Wasn't that why they were all there after all? Neither bride nor groom looked toward the painting of the last wife, whose influence lay like a film all over the magnificent house. Eyes scanned the new wife's gold dress, Versace maybe, figure-hugging, but an inch too short for this society crowd. The heels, half an inch too high. The jewelry, thick coils around her neck and hanging from her ears, impressive but attention-seeking. All the women, nearly all over 50, would be making the same assessment. She's not one of us. Marcy knew how that felt.
Her name's Keisha.
Elizabeth bustled over, dragging Marcy's attention away. Staid office wear had been abandoned for the night in favor of a green dress that looked new, although certainly not Versace. Elizabeth's short, dark, curly hair, run through with wiry gray, had been fluffed up so she looked like an aging poodle. Did Elizabeth feel it too? This frisson of excitement, of change, their feathers being ruffled by the sudden arrival of this cuckoo. She's just turned 22 and is from London, Elizabeth continued, leaning in closer, eyes twinkling with the as yet unspilled gossip, happy to have snippets of information to share that might make her feel part of the set. There was a fondness for her, but it was the kind of affection you might give an old dog simply because it always wanted to please you. Elizabeth might have been Eleanor's assistant forever, and then Williams when Eleanor got too sick. But she was still only staff. William said she was family, but Marcy knew better. Real family mattered in this circle of friends. Your blood. How far back your name went. There was pride in history. Elizabeth had no eminent cotton or sugar ancestry, and no style. She'd been stillborn into the waters of this society.
That's where they met. London, 4 months ago. A whirlwind romance. William wanted to keep their early return as a surprise, but someone had to get them home and arrange all this.
Elizabeth wafted a hand around as if she'd been spending her own money on the occasion.
He swore me to secrecy, but thank the Lord for Julian and Pierre. They truly do organize the best parties.
She smiled again.
Here come the happy couple, Emmett muttered.
William was always going to bring her to them first, his best friends, the club set. And then it was a flurry of exclamations and smiles and wafts of perfume as each of the women leaned in to air kiss the pair. Marcy, the other second wife, the older second wife, took a few involuntary steps backward as the rest crowded in. Up close, Keisha was even more magnificent. Her skin was a deep, rich brown. She glowed. Eleanor had glowed once, too. Marcy watched her friends chirping their joy. The queen is dead. Long live the queen. Vying to be the happiest at the new union. Iris, bird-like and papery old, but elegantly preserved, and her husband, Noah, the judge, portly, red-faced, and yet somewhat regal, the two of them cornerstones of Savannah society. Virginia, constantly smiling, her body starved to slim, but her full face, under her Stepford wife blowout, forever betraying the larger size her God had meant her to be. She was a stalwart of the church, where she was adored almost as much as Jesus himself for the size of her charitable donations. Beside her was her foppish husband Emmett, slight and short and impeccably dressed. Also somewhere in his mid-50s, he brokered various stocks and shares to pretend to himself that he didn't simply while away his life on inherited wealth, using the club as an easy pool for investors. Sometimes, in the increasingly frequent bad moods that struck when this life threatened to suffocate her, Marcy wondered if she'd reach menopause early just by being around so much middle age. But now, in the wake of poor Eleanor's demise, here was youth among them, a shard of obsidian glistening in the staid, patted-down chalk. Freshness, excitement. And 22. 4 years younger than Marcy had been when she'd met Jason. An affair, a year or so of melodrama, an unpleasant divorce, goodbye, Jackie. And by 29, she had been the young second wife taking careful steps to find her place in this world. Now she was nearly 35, with Jason coming up on 53, and she was cemented, stuck, into the set. But Jason wasn't like the others in many ways. Not quite of the same stock, even though his family had been around for generations. And then there was the business with his father. He'd had to rise above that. No mean feat in this world. He'd crawled back onto the social ladder while married to Jackie. It was something they had in common, this tenacity to achieve more. And Marcy was determined they'd keep climbing. She looked at the chattering, gushing wealth embodied in her friends. How wonderful it must be to be born an Iris or a William, when people hung on your every word, wanted to please you. Royalty. Shame they didn't have anything of note to say. But then they didn't have to. She glanced toward Jason, wanting to share a quick secret smile at the ridiculousness of all this. But her husband's eyes were on Keisha. Marcy watched as his hand half-stroked the young woman's bare arm when he leaned in to kiss her cheek, as if he couldn't resist touching her. Unlike the women's, this was no air kiss. Did his lips linger against Keisha's flawless skin a fraction too long? He wasn't smiling, not amusedly dazzled like the others, and she noted his Adam's apple dipping as he swallowed. She knew that look too well. Lust. It was the way he'd looked at her in the first heat after they'd met. He hadn't looked at her like that for a while. She felt her stomach constrict, her champagne suddenly sour. Once a cheat, always a cheat.
Jason, introduce your wife. Where are your manners? Oh, these boys. Yes, Marcy, what are you doing back there? Come on in. Marcy.
For a moment, she didn't even recognize her own name, still feeling the sting of that heated expression in Jason's eyes. And then the huddle parted as William's thick fingers touched her arm, and she automatically smiled, all worry hidden away. Congratulations, she said softly. I'm so happy for you. She turned to Keisha, tall and glorious in front of her, suddenly feeling old. And of course, lovely to meet you. Their eyes stayed locked for a second or two too long, rich, deep brown on her watery blue. And Marcy knew she was being appraised, judged, in a way the other wives hadn't been. They were in a different age bracket. They weren't competition. But maybe Marcy wasn't so old after all. I feel like I already know you all. Keisha's English accent was hard and clipped, strangely captivating. You all. Two words. Even Marcy now automatically drawled them together in that southern liquid way. Billy's talked about you so much. Billy? Eleanor would turn in her grave. William Radford IV was no one's Billy, or at least he hadn't been. Times were changing. Keisha turned her attention back to Jason. Especially you, the great Jason Maddox, the brains of the firm and all-around great guy. I hope you don't disappoint. She winked, flirtatious and friendly, at ease with being the center of attention, and then laughed, a surprisingly brash sound, or perhaps just uninhibited. And they all dutifully joined in, a tinkling of politeness. When Jason winked back at the new star in their firmament, Marcy wasn't sure if she wanted to rip this breathtaking woman's eyes out, or go and scream in a corner.
I know this has all been sudden, and you may think we're crazy.
William took two glasses of champagne from a passing waiter, handing one to his new bride, and then letting his fingers slide down to the curve of her back.
But when you know, you know. Keisha brought life back into my heart. I didn't think that was possible. You didn't want to take the other 6 months as a honeymoon?
Jason asked, at last looking at William.
You were so adamant you were going for a year. Plans change, Jason. Plans change. And how could I stay away from my wonderful friends for so long? Well, I know you're retiring, but no work tonight.
William slapped Jason hard, maybe a little too hard, on the arm.
Now, come on, let's go eat. I want Keisha to see what she's been missing out on over there in London.
He leaned into Jason.
And I should thank you. If you hadn't told me all the best places to go on my trip, I'd never have found her.
As they walked away, friends following in their wake, Marcy noticed that this time it was William who Jason was watching. A dark, thoughtful expression. Maybe Keisha was upsetting the apple cart for both of them. Once the champagne and cocktails had washed away their polite shock and the band had struck up on the terrace, the party turned out to be less of a bore than Marcy had been expecting. The guests kicked off their shoes and danced in the night air, care for expensive dresses forgotten, and even Iris and Noah took a turn on the grass. As they swayed, Marcy thought she caught a glimpse of ghosts of the teenage sweethearts they'd once been. Marcy watched as Jason chatted loudly to some of the other guests. She couldn't get the look he'd given Keisha out of her head. He'd been pulling away for a few months, but she'd put it down to work, the responsibility of running the partnership while William was away, gearing up to take the next step of buying him out. Their sex life had dwindled down to occasional drunken screws, and she wondered if those were only to fulfill his need for a child, an heir, a social accessory they could send to Country Day and expand their affluent network. Looking at him now, the same questions swirled in her head as they had for weeks. Had he grown bored of her? Was she a challenge completed? Now, here, in that look that whispered thoughts of betrayal, there had been the first clear fracture in the structure of their marriage. She'd never seen him look at another woman that way. Never. Keisha had come to join them once or twice, increasingly unsteady on her feet, but still trying to twirl and shimmy to the music, head thrown back, laughing that raucous, fascinating sound. She lingered too close to where Jason and Marcy were sharing a lounger later in the evening. And although Jason did snatch the occasional glance her way, if Keisha was looking for further flirtation, she was disappointed. But still, that look. William, following constantly in his young wife's shadow, finally led her away, and they didn't see her again. Given her state, he probably had Zelda, his housekeeper, put her to bed. Virginia was all raised eyebrows, even though she wasn't beyond having one or two drinks too many when the mood took her, church or no church. But Iris pointed out that it must be hard to move across the world and be expected to live up to someone like Eleanor when you were so completely different. Completely different. What she meant was young, crude, and the most unspoken word of all, black. Anyway, Keisha hadn't seemed awkward, just a drunk girl who didn't care what people thought of her, because she'd just won the jackpot, a rich old man. Still, it wasn't a prize Marcy would want to win. The thought of William heaving away on top of her. Oh, God, no wonder Keisha had been draining the champagne and flirting with her husband. 3. She and Jason finally got home around 1, and before they'd even turned on the lights, he was kissing her, catching her by surprise.
You want to have another go at making a baby?
He grinned, his mouth all lopsided charm, made somehow more attractive by the beer haze in his eyes. And before Marcy could answer, he was pulling her up the stairs and tugging at her clothes. She couldn't help laughing. Yes, he was drunk, but she wasn't exactly sober herself, and it was good to feel him wanting her again, to be close to him, to be something like they were before. Maybe she was wrong to worry earlier. Keisha was beautiful, but he loved her, his wife. They fell onto the bed, only half naked, a mess of panting urgency. She sought out his eyes in the gloom as he pushed her arms over her head, holding her wrists down with one hand. She tried to nuzzle at his face to get him to look at her, to kiss her. With Marcy's legs gripping his waist, he thrust himself inside her. She gasped. She always did. There had never been a man who could come close to Jason at turning her on. But his face stayed pressed into her shoulder, his breath dampening her skin as it quickened. He's not with me. The thought was a cold shower between her thighs. He's not thinking of me. He finished fast, and when he flopped over to his side of the bed, Marcy stayed breathless. It was one thing that they rarely fucked anymore, but until now, when they had, she'd always felt he was present. Not this time. Had he been thinking of her? It was nothing. It meant nothing. People fantasized all the time. She was overreacting. What was it about Keisha that unsettled her so?
I love you,
Jason said, perfunctorily, his hand reaching across and resting on her thigh. I know, she answered, and let out a chuckle she didn't feel. She couldn't make a thing of it. She wouldn't.
Oh, so funny, Mrs. Maddox.
He let out a long, contented sigh. Marcy's heart was still racing. I think she likes you, she said, the words blurting out. At least she sounded mildly amused, not jealous or insecure. His eyes were no longer shut. He was staring at the ceiling.
Who?
You know who,
Why hadn't she kept her mouth shut? She felt stupid, obvious. Keisha!
Ah, that's she.
He stared at the ceiling a moment longer, expression unreadable in the dark. And then he rolled back on top of her and smiled.
Your old man still got it. You better work harder to keep me.
He kissed her, slow and soft, and she kissed him back, but she felt hollow. She'd worked hard enough to get him. She didn't want the rest of her life spent working hard to keep him. Was he even worth it? Half an hour later, when he was sprawled out and snoring, Marcy got up and padded into her dressing room beyond the his and hers bathrooms. Under the glare of the light, she looked at herself. She remembered how proud the new Mrs. Radford had been coming down those stairs. How beautiful. The way she danced, so drunk. She didn't care. That was it. She reminded Marcy of someone she herself used to be a long time ago, back before she'd met Jason, before she had entered this world. When had she started to feel so small? Was it when the house, much as she adored their new home, got so big? Or was it after the boutique failed and they, Jason, quietly decided that a life in business wasn't for her? No more expensive hobbies. When had she stopped being hungry for excitement? When she'd become a good Southern wife? Was Keisha a reminder of all she'd given up for this life? And was that why she felt so untethered around her? Too much time for self-reflection, she decided as she opened her small chest of creams and toiletries. She'd have to wait and see how it all panned out. No doubt Keisha would be in a nice prim dress and pearls, full submissive wife, before the first whisper of fall. And Jason would be back to his normal, charming, attentive self. She would make sure of it. Keisha was just a small bump, a momentary distraction. She was determined to get their marriage back on track. After all, wasn't this all she'd ever wanted? The thought didn't bring her as much comfort as she expected. Was she angry at Jason for getting bored with her because she knew deep down that she, in turn, was growing bored of him? Maybe this had been what she wanted, but that was before she'd gotten it. Now her wants had changed. She was tired of being so goddamn dependent, grateful. Even so wealthy, she felt like a second-class citizen. The other wives might tolerate her, but she didn't have any of their respect. And these days, she wasn't even sure she had Jason's. She'd hoped money would bring that, to finally be a person of merit, no longer looked down on. But apparently, it wasn't enough.
You want to have another go at making a baby?
The thought of bringing a child into this made her stomach tense. If they divorced and she was saddled with a kid, then what? No man here would want her with baggage. She worried at her lip as she looked in the mirror. Making sure the door was locked, she carefully pulled away the inner lining of her vanity case and took out the strip of pills hidden inside. She stared long and hard in the mirror, and her eyes hardened as she popped one free. No, Marcy thought, looking up at the air conditioning grill on the ceiling as she swallowed the secret contraceptive. No. I don't want to make a fucking baby. 4. Marcy wished they'd had this late lunch at the house rather than on Iris and Noah Cartwright's boat moored at the end of the jetty. Perhaps then she wouldn't be forcing a smile through her nausea from the slight movement of the creek beneath them. Although it was a still day, the air was humid and heavy with the endless heat suffocating the city, and even the water was lazy in its wake. Iris knew Marcy got motion sickness, but Noah loved his boat, and they always entertained on it in the summer. It was a tradition, and it had been clear from the start that they wouldn't change for Marcy.
You have to get used to it, Jason had said when they'd first gotten married. Water's in the veins as much as blood here. We grow up on it. But I guess you're all landlubbers back in Boise, Idaho.
He'd smiled as he teased her, and she'd wanted to point out that they had water in Boise, too, but he wouldn't have cared. That was one thing she and Keisha had in common. They were both from elsewhere. Boise could be as far away as London. Only the South mattered. In the main, Marcy liked it that way. At least this would be the last of the boat for a while. Noah and Iris were going away to the Hamptons to visit their beloved daughter, Heather, the only girl out of their four children. She was a few years older and frumpier than Marcy, and had just had their latest grandson, whose name Marcy couldn't remember, even though she'd dutifully bought gifts of booties, baby gowns, and bears for him, and gushed over photos. Babies all looked the same to her, and given Jason's recent thirst to reproduce, she was always happier when the subject changed. She leaned her head against her husband's broad shoulder and breathed slowly as the queasy moment passed. Across the table, Keisha clearly wasn't bothered by the movement of the water. She had a half-empty margarita in one hand while biting into a plump king prawn plucked from the platter of iced seafood in the middle of the table. It wasn't her first. She ate with gusto while Marcy, Iris, and Virginia sipped Chardonnay and let their stomachs gnaw on their own lining. Iris occasionally fed Midge, their old tabby cat, a fishy tidbit, as if it made up for her barely eating herself. "They don't come like this in Tesco," Keisha said, and Virginia, still primly dressed from church, laughed, although she probably didn't know what Tesco was any more than Marcy did. Keisha was wearing a thin summer dress, and as she leaned over to kiss William on the cheek with her wet, glossy lips, the curves of her breasts were clearly visible. Jason had his aviators on, and when Marcy glanced his way, was he looking? All she could see was her own distorted face reflected back at her. Keisha showed no signs of a hangover from the previous night's party. If anything, she was still glowing with health. But William looked tired. Poor old fool. Marcy heard the words in Eleanor's voice, always so forgiving of her man.
"More wine, Virginia?"
Noah refilled the glasses. Wine never in short supply here, and Virginia took it gratefully. She'd had an exhausting morning at the church, she told them. So much to help with, charity events to organize. She was alone. Emmett had a prior engagement with some investment client. The number of times he took meetings on Sundays was a clue to everyone bar his wife that he wasn't as keen on prayer as Virginia. Marcy imagined that the endless hours of fundraising and work at the homeless refuge that filled her hours could grate very quickly.
"I called you this morning, William," Jason said. "Zelda told me you were on the treadmill." "She didn't mention it." "It wasn't important, but jogging. I've never known you to do more than stroll around the golf course."
Jason had called William? Marcy hadn't known that. When? Had she been in the shower? Had he hidden himself in one of the many empty rooms in their new house? Why would he need to speak to William on a Sunday morning when he knew they'd be seeing each other later? A thought curled like dark smoke. Had he been hoping Keisha would answer, maybe?
"Never too late to get in shape," William said. "My new routine, up early, down to the treadmill, and then a coconut water to raise my energy. I tell you, I feel 20 years younger."
"Are you sure that's the jogging?"
Iris, ever the dry wit, raised an overplucked eyebrow and glanced at Keisha.
"She sure helps,"
William conceded, and everyone smiled. Marcy tried to imagine him on the running machine. It wasn't a pretty image. The state-of-the-art home gym had been Eleanor's, and she'd used it religiously. A fat lot of good it had done her in the end.
"Do you jog too?"
Marcy asked. She imagined Keisha in tight gym gear and regretted asking the question immediately. That was not an image she wanted in Jason's mind.
"No, I'm a night owl. Nothing wakes me before 10, sometimes even midday, but I'm trying to change. I know I've married an early bird."
Marcy couldn't imagine Keisha changing, conforming. But then she had. It was amazing how you could contain yourself, imprison yourself if you really tried, if you loved someone. She looked down at her sweet summer dress from that new expensive little boutique on Broughton that all the club wives loved so much. cuff sleeves, buttons down the front, deck shoes on her feet. 6 or 7 years ago, she'd have been wearing cut-off denim shorts that showed the curve of her ass and wouldn't be seen dead in something as old as this. Probably why her own store had failed. She hadn't known back then how sedately her customer base dressed. Well, that and all the bad-mouthing from Jason's ex-wife. Marcy should have let the dust settle before trying to do something for herself. Now she was trapped in an expensive cotton and reliant on her husband's credit card. "Although I draw the line at coconut water," Keisha continued. "It's disgusting. It tastes like sperm. No wonder Billy drains the carton in one go." Iris nearly choked on her wine at that. Combined with the appalled look on William's face and the flush on Noah's, Marcy couldn't help but laugh. Jason joined in, and then so did Iris. "I'm so sorry. I have no filter." Keisha clapped a hand over her mouth, her eyes suddenly nervous as they glanced at William. For a moment, he looked like he might implode, and then, seeing that his friends weren't offended, his face relaxed slightly into a taut grin.
"I'll take your word for it on the taste."
He squeezed her knee, and looking at his fat, white hand on Keisha's young, dark skin made Marcy think of that English king, the one with all the wives she'd watched the TV show about. Old and fat, and with a beautiful young girl he believed loved him. Didn't end well for the women, if she remembered correctly. "It's so hot," Keisha said when the titter stopped. She leaned back in her chair and looked out over the water. "And muggy."
"Welcome to the South," Noah drawled.
He'd been virtually dozing for the past hour or so, an old beached walrus splayed on his seat. But now he picked up a piece of cornbread and tore away a corner to eat, despite Iris's side eye. Noah could do with losing more than a pound or two himself.
"Storms that come in fast and clear away as quick. Heat that clings to you like a needy child."
"You'll learn to move slower," Virginia added, fanning herself with a coaster. "In this weather, you don't get a choice." "Oh, I love it. I can feel my whole body relaxing, but," Keisha said, unfurling from her chair like a languid cat, "I also can't resist the water." She kissed William, chased on the cheek, and then her shoulders were slipping free of her sundress, which slid to the floor, revealing a string bikini beneath it. "I'm going in." She was already pushing the ladder over the edge and climbing over the side, oblivious to the eyes on her body, William calling her back, and the look of disapproval on Virginia's face as she declared, "Oh my." Keisha jumped from the boat's edge, arms in the air, a whoop of joy carrying her down into the splash. And by the time the others were on their feet and at the railing, she was breaking the surface, treading water, face full of delight.
Be careful,
Noah called, leaning over the side.
We get gators sometimes.
Keisha ignored him and ducked under the water again, childlike in her joy.
She's quite the live wire, isn't she?
Iris said. But there was no hint of disapproval. If anything, she sounded surprisingly impressed. What would Eleanor make of her best friend embracing her replacement so quickly?
She needs to learn to control her urges, William grumbled.
Oh, she's just young, Iris said. So much energy. I can see why she caught your eye, William.
Marcy could see why Keisha had caught William's eye written all over Jason's face. He'd pushed his glasses on top of his head and was looking down at the glittering water and the woman in it. Marcy slid her arm through his, the feel of his cotton shirt and the taut arm under it, both familiar and exciting. But he didn't respond. It was as if she wasn't even there. Keisha, squinting in the sun, one arm shading her eyes, was looking up at him.
You guys should come in, I dare you.
No one said a word. And Marcy, hot and queasy, thought how nice it would be to strip to her underwear and jump from the god-awful boat. But she wasn't a novelty like Keisha, the new pet, the unreal girl in their midst. And Virginia would have it all around the club that Marcy Maddox was basically naked on Judge Cartwright's boat and trying to compete with William Radford's gorgeous new wife.
"Never mind the alligators," Keisha said. I'm surrounded by chickens.
William looked around the group, disgruntled and in no shape to strip and swim in the creek.
I've done my exercise for the day. One of you will have to entertain my wife.
His eyes fell on Jason, who, as if he needed no more encouragement, pulled his arm free from Marcy's and started to unbutton his shirt.
What are you doing?
What does it look like I'm doing? Someone has to go in.
This isn't the office, Marcy hissed. You don't have to do what William says.
Until he officially retires, I do. It's fine. Don't make a deal of it.
Marcy bit her lip. She wasn't making a deal of it. She just didn't see why it had to be him. Maybe I should go in instead.
Don't be stupid. You hate the creek, and I'm half undressed now.
He was unzipping his pants, kicking them away and leaving just his black Calvin Klein shorts, a trail of dark, coarse hair spreading from his flat stomach up across his broad, tanned chest. How must he look to Keisha next to William? Desirable. She caught Virginia's sharp eyes registering her displeasure, and she quickly turned her frown into the grimace of a smile as they joined the others.
I'd go in myself, she said, but I'm not wearing any panties.
No one laughed, all watching Jason as he dived over the side, splashing Keisha and making her squeal.
I'm kidding.
Marcy picked up her glass from the table and leaned over the railing.
Of course I'm wearing underwear.
She was smarting. If Keisha had said it, they'd all have found it funny. What was so different? She drank some more wine, large swallows as they gathered, crows on a wire, observers of the sport below. Jason ducked beneath the surface, invisible for what seemed like forever, as Keisha twisted around looking for him. And then finally she shrieked as he pulled at her feet.
You bastard!
He popped back up, laughing and coughing as she splashed water into his face. It was like watching teenagers. What was William thinking of this display? Jason was at home in the water in a way that Marcy never could be. She liked to see what was around her. The creek could be murky, and that word, alligator, was never far from her thoughts. Keisha and the potential alligator merged in her mind, a predator waiting to consume her husband. She drank more wine, her thoughts hardening. Keisha might learn the hard way that Marcy was hardly prey herself. As it was, Keisha didn't stay in the water much longer and was soon back on deck and wrapped in a robe Iris spirited up from a cabin below, yawning happily. Jason sat beside Keisha.
I don't want to get creek water all over you, honey.
You should have come in, she said to Marcy, all nice as pie. Jason's like a fish, isn't he?
Yes, slippery, she wanted to answer.
I prefer poolside to creek water. You never know what you'll catch in there.
Or what will catch you, Virginia murmured with a smile. She'd been drinking steadily since she'd arrived and was now on the tipsy end of sober, her hamster cheeks shining in the heat. Was that a snipe? Hard to tell. Virginia was Marcy's friend because she and Emmett had known William forever, and so also by default, Jason. But there were 20 years between the two women. Marcy could fake the church thing for the sake of appearances, showing up once a month or so and helping out at the soup kitchen. But she was never going to buy into God, whatever she put in the plate. Virginia, who could be so patronizing, but who'd never worked a day in her life. No, maybe they weren't friends. Maybe they just tolerated her for Jason's sake. For all she knew, they still spoke to Jackie regularly. She looked at the beauty opposite her, fighting jet lag, but whose yawns were signaling the end of the afternoon. Keisha had a lot to learn about their set. Suddenly, Marcy felt very alone, out of place. Home time, I think, she murmured. No one disagreed. 5. It was with relief that Marcy closed the heavy front door behind them and stepped into the cool of their house, her sanctuary. Her head ached with the remnants of her seasickness, too much heat, and this awful fear that she was losing her grip on everything.
plus the wine, she conceded. Even though it was still early, all she wanted was a shower and to go to bed. The car ride had been quiet after she'd closed down any conversation Jason tried to start. His good mood had been bubbling over, his enjoyment of the afternoon in direct opposition to how dark she now felt. Once a cheat, always a cheat. Thrill seekers seek thrills, and that's all there is to it. Just be careful, dear. The words still stung, said by a near stranger, one of Jackie's friends, in the club's restroom when she and Jason first came out as a couple. Not long after the divorce, Jackie had met a retired orthopedic surgeon and moved to Atlanta. She no longer had cheat worries, though. Her second husband had died of a massive heart attack not long before Eleanor passed away, apparently. Jackie was now off in Florida somewhere, on an extended vacation on his insurance. It almost gave Marcy a pang of envy. All that freedom. I didn't know you'd called William this morning, she said, kicking off her shoes, the cold tiles delicious on her hot feet.
Doesn't matter.
You didn't mention it, that's all. Is everything okay?
He wasn't due home until after Thanksgiving. I wanted to see if he was going back to work or not.
Couldn't you have asked him this afternoon? She got herself a glass of water and swallowed two Advil from the cupboard. This throbbing head wasn't helping her mood, and her stomach was tight, nervy. Did she want a fight? No, she didn't. So why was she pestering him?
No business when socializing, remember? William hates that. Anyway, why does it matter? What's wrong with you today? It was work.
Like jumping in the creek was work? There was a long pause after that, and her heart raced. Finally, Jason put his beer bottle down on the counter and stared at her.
Why are you acting like this?
She stared right back at him. I think you like her.
Don't be ridiculous.
He looked so appalled, she very nearly believed him, until he uttered the death knell of denial.
She's not my type.
The words were a slap in the face. He did want her, and not just in a yeah, she's hot, so I would, jokey way.
Really?
The word dripped from her, heavy with sarcasm.
For God's sake, Marcy, am I never supposed to look at another woman ever? Is that how you'd like me, castrated?
That's not what I'm saying. What was she saying? This seems different, that's all. It makes me feel odd, and I don't know why. She suddenly felt teary. She was making it worse.
I don't want to sleep with her, Jason said, softened by her upset. I just find her refreshing, I guess.
Refreshing?
You know.
He shrugged.
A bit wild, young, different from our friends.
Your friends is what she wanted to snap at him, but she bit it back. They weren't Marcy's friends. They'd simply absorbed her into them, scrubbed her up and made her respectable. She hadn't fought it because she loved him. She'd allowed it. I'm not boring, she said. And he burst out laughing.
No, he said. No, you're not. A bit crazy, maybe, but not boring.
He reached out and pulled her close, kissing the top of her head. A sterile kiss.
She's young, that's all.
He breathed hot on her scalp.
Too young for me.
Thought no man ever. Later that night, when she snuck away to take her no-baby-thank-you-very-much pill and had locked the dressing room door, she stood on her vanity chair and carefully removed the overhead vent cover. Up on her tiptoes, she reached as far as she could and pulled out the small tin sandwich box she kept hidden there. She calmed a little, just running her fingers over the surface. Why was she feeling the need to look inside? Keisha, 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 that was why. Remembering how Jason had looked at her in the water, how desperately eager he'd been to abandon Marcy and jump in to join her, Marcy wanted to kill him. It was what men never understood. The little disregards hurt the most,
The shift from adoration to feeling comfortable, taken for granted, disrespected. She had never wanted that. She didn't want that. Her blood ran too hot in her veins. She stared at the box, her reminder of how far she'd come, her anchor. Whenever this life she fought so hard for made her feel suffocated, all she needed was to look at the box. Yeah, life wasn't the perfection she'd hoped for, but things could be a lot, lot worse. She didn't need to open it to know that the first item, the one that covered all her other memories, was a photo of her and Jason, her arms around his neck, both laughing, free. Back when they'd first met, when everything was passion and they'd have died for each other. God, how she missed that passion. Thrill seekers seek thrills, and that's all there is to it. No, she thought, that's not true. People can change. People do change. Everything was going to be fine. Marcy and Jason Maddox were meant to be. Weren't they? 6. Keisha couldn't get back to sleep. She wished she could turn off the air conditioning and feel the night heat, which might help soothe away the ants in her brain that were keeping her awake. The worries, the sense of isolation, the anxiety and dark, muddled thinking that had plagued her since she was a child and now were threatening to return. Her eyes kept glancing to the corner of the room where the shadows stretched longest. When she'd woken, she'd been sure she'd see him there, a ghostly boy emerging from the gloom, as if he'd followed her from her childhood and her dreams to this place so far away from home. She'd shivered, repeating the words that had been her mantra all her life. There was no boy. There was no ghost. Until her breathing evened out. Still, though, she felt panicky, lying so still and awake in the night. Billy wouldn't sleep with a nightlight on. He'd laughed at her when she'd asked him. He laughed at her a lot, or shouted. Don't fuck this up, she told herself. Fuck. Billy didn't like it when she swore, and she tried hard not to speak like she had at home, where cursing was part of the vernacular. Despite the Egyptian cotton sheets, soft against her naked skin, she was consumed with a longing for home. The traffic noise, the dirt, the tiny flat on the 10th floor of a building where the lift mostly didn't work, where the stairwells stank of piss and the corridors were filled with broken old people trying to hold on to their dignity in a changed, uncaring world, while teenagers tried to sell you crack. Everything was different here, and not just the way of life and the quiet, still nights. In London, her family and all the other girls at the club had laughed at Billy's pathetic romantic overtures until they realized what he was worth, and then it didn't matter that he was old and fat. Then they'd all made sure his pursuit of Keisha was serious. The dollar signs were lit up bright in everyone she knew. Think of the money, her uncle Yehuba had said, eyes flashing sharp with endless greed. Dolly had said the same, teeth gritting with envy, and all the other women nodding along. They were hard girls at the club, no goodness in them. Grifters, graspers, making hundreds of pounds by night, and none of them with the sense to save a penny. Smile, dance, and take the money, drink your way through it. More fool the men. But Keisha with her odd moods and erratic behavior, had not been like that. The dancing she could do, the feeling of being lost in music under a spotlight, real life forgotten, but not the men. And so she'd become a drinks waitress, her tight clothing staying on, no hands allowed to paw at her. She certainly didn't do afters, even knowing she could have made so much more, enough to break free of her uncle's control, perhaps, to pay her family back what they said she owed them for raising her. And then maybe enough to run somewhere even her awful dreams couldn't find her. The air conditioning clicked and started to hum again. The sound enough to keep her awake, without the addition of Billy's sleeping pig grunts and snuffles beside her. Her sleeping prince, her hero, she had hit the jackpot with him. Her. Everyone had seen, a rich, lonely American widower.
she'd have been stupid not to grab at it. And once her uncle and auntie had seen the gifts he'd bought her, she'd had no choice. Back then, at the beginning, she hadn't even minded. Billy was kind. He was fragile, almost. He was saving her, and maybe she could help with his fear of being old, dying, rotting away like his first wife. He was a man who had been forced to look in the mirror and realize that time was no longer on his side. Auntie Io had told him there would be no lingering cancer for him after the long and awkward wedding celebration where Keisha had been forced to take him to Peckham and watch her relatives circling like sharks. They'd both drunk too much to get through it. Auntie Io said he wouldn't die in his own shit. People believed her, said she had a gift, a knowing. It shone through, and Billy was no exception, although Keisha could see that Auntie Io slightly scared him too. He'd fallen for Keisha harder after that, seeing himself as her knight in shining armor, saving her from her wicked relatives. He'd said she was his lucky charm. She made him feel young, as if there was clean, new breath in his lungs. And she'd thought a life with Billy, even with everyone else clamoring for her to clean him out, could be good. An escape. Her past wouldn't haunt her. Perhaps no more dreams of the boy who was never there, the ghost boy who cursed her. She couldn't wait to get here. But now she was living it, and everything was different. He'd changed too, now that they were in this hot, alien place that was his comfort zone. He was shedding his lonely widower skin.
"Don't ever embarrass me like that again,"
he'd said on the way back from the boat this afternoon, his warm smile dissolving as soon as they'd gotten in the car. His whole demeanor suddenly colder than any chill the AC could put out.
"This isn't some trashy part of London, and my friends aren't your revolting family. You can't talk like that here."
She was so stunned at the sudden shift in his mood. Only seconds earlier, he'd been holding her hand as they said their farewells, that it took her a moment to realize he'd meant her comment about the coconut water.
"Everyone laughed," she'd answered softly. "It was just a joke."
"You sounded like a whore."
His words were bile, raw acid hitting her. Only after she'd burst into startled tears, full of apologies, did he pat her on the knee, as if reassuring a scalded child, and tell her he loved her. It was a moment of revelation. Now that she'd married him, all the things he'd said wouldn't matter actually did. He was well-respected. He had power. He didn't want to be embarrassed, not even by her, maybe especially not by her. He wanted her to be perfect. She took a deep breath. She could do this. "He'll be dead soon enough," Dolly had said when they'd hugged goodbye, "with you riding him every night." They'd laughed at that too, but even the sex was harder work than she'd expected. It went one of two ways. If he was feeling sweet and sentimental and hadn't taken a Viagra, he simply labored for hours with his head between her thighs, checking she was happy, while she fantasized until she finally came, or faked it like a porn star. Her sex chafed from his crude mouth. Either way, she made sure she climaxed noisily. A man like William would never understand a true female orgasm. Quiet, intense, private. What validation would there be for him in that? Then there was the other sex, the Viagra sex, reclaiming his youth. All the things he'd never done with his saintly first wife he wanted to do now, with her. Of course she had to let him while finding the line between agreeing and not behaving like a whore. He wouldn't like that. Tonight had been that kind of sex, and she felt bruised and hollow. She wished her friends from the club, Dolly, Ange, and Sabina, were here. They'd know how to play this better than her. It had all sounded much easier in London. She pushed the sheets back and reached for her robe, pulling the thin silk around her strong body. She was too restless to just lie there, corpse-like, as the hours ticked around until dawn. She needed to move, to remind herself of what she'd won, to shake off this feeling that she'd been duped into imprisonment so far from home, and that it might break her. Downstairs, she went to the kitchen first, draining milk straight from the container to settle the acid burning her chest from an afternoon's drinking. She stared at all the stupid individual cartons of coconut water that Billy somehow thought would make him young again. It did taste like sperm, however much he may not have liked the comment. She wanted to twist one open and spit in it. She closed the fridge and padded out into the vast hallway. Eleanor stared down at her in the gloom, her expression unreadable, and Keisha shivered. There was no space for the boy here. It was Eleanor's ghost who stalked this house, the dead mother of the dead son. Keisha could feel her. She was on the walls and in the walls. Her energy, the blood that ran through the veins of this mansion. Her clothes were still in the closets of the master bedroom. Billy and Keisha used a different room for now. And her drawers were filled with her trinkets and memories. Keisha had looked. Of course she had. Her need to know about what came before had been overwhelming. Tucked away in a cabinet against one wall were so many framed photos of Lyle, the dead son and heir, that Keisha had been afraid they would tumble out and her nosing around would be discovered. Lyle had died before Eleanor and William had moved into this house. His death and Eleanor's grief, the cause of the move. But it was strange to Keisha that all his pictures were hidden away, from kindergarten and with school friends, to the proud young man in his military uniform, the uniform he'd die in, serving in Afghanistan shortly after. Billy had said he'd been killed 15 years before. If he'd lived, he'd be older than Keisha. Would she have liked him more than his father? He had a sweet face, she thought, shining eyes. No wonder Billy still couldn't bear to talk about it. No wonder they'd hidden their grief away. On the dresser were more photos, displayed this time. Old pictures of Eleanor and her friends or siblings, maybe as children. And also of the happy couple, Billy barely recognizable as a young man, and Eleanor aloofly elegant. And then in the drawers, hidden amid various items of carefully folded clothes, she found some jewelry and a small box containing far more interesting treasure. A bag of grass and cigarette papers and a sealed packet of syringes alongside a vial of morphine. That was a revelation. Perhaps Eleanor had kept a lot of her pain from Billy and her nurses, or Iris and Elizabeth and whoever else looked after her. Maybe there had been more to the saintly Eleanor than met the eye. Everything about this world felt like an act. Keisha wandered through the house, resisting the urge to go back upstairs and dip further into the dead wife's possessions, instead taking comfort in the endless rooms and fine furniture. Her domain now. The demands of her family were an ocean away, just the one man to take care of. Keep him happy, she thought. He's nearly 70. He'll be dead soon. It was a harsh and horrible thought, but she couldn't help it. There had been no prenup. It had all moved too quickly for that, her family pouncing while he'd been intoxicated by her. But he'd made her sign a postnup as soon as they'd landed, maybe the first clue that her knight in shining armor wasn't so soft. She knew, even when he died, that she wouldn't get everything, but she'd get enough. Plenty to get her family off her back, and then maybe to flee somewhere wonderful where none of them could find her. Her stomach fizzed as she passed a wall of photographs, black tie events at the country club, with various politicians or local celebrities. There were a few now familiar faces smiling out from some of the pictures, and as her eyes lingered on one, a hand subconsciously floated up to her neck, teasing the skin there, imagining a touch as her heart raced. This was the bright light in her new life. She thought back to the laughter on the boat, their eyes meeting, the way she felt in the excitement of a flirtation. Never had Billy seemed so old and ridiculous beside her. She'd felt breathless, girlish, giddy, alive, an overwhelming surge of lust. She needed to be careful, she knew that. She couldn't put all this at risk with one of her wild emotional obsessions. She had to keep her head straight, to concentrate on Billy, and that meant not getting distracted. She took a last glance at one of the photos before turning away. She had to keep those feelings boxed up for private moments, something to fantasize about while Billy wheezed and slobbered all over her. She turned the alarm off and went out onto the terrace, the night a wall of heat to penetrate, no hint of a breeze. It calmed her, though. She had to think kinder thoughts about Billy. He had rescued her from a life she hated and a family who scared her. This was a beautiful place. She had to find a way to enjoy it until it was all hers. Tiny yellow bulbs twinkled on strings in the trees, leftovers from the party. A light was also still on in the apartment above the garages where Zelda lived. She must be a night owl, too. What time was it? 1 in the morning? 2? The light went out as she stared up at the window and she smiled. Maybe Zelda had the right idea. It was too late to be awake. She should have taken a pill or something to help her sleep. There was only so long Billy would put up with her sleeping half the morning, and the less time she could spend in bed, the less chance there was of him pawing at her more. She took a last look at the glittering trees and then went back into the cool house. Her skin had goose pimpled as she crept back under the sheets. And for a while, she just lay in the dark, lost in her heated thoughts of eyes meeting, before finally, she fell into a fitful sleep of lustful dreams and family memories she'd rather forget. 7. It was 10 when Keisha woke, the sheets tangled between her thighs like a drained lover, and she squinted against the light that streamed through the large windows. It made her feel good, a fresh start. Today, she would be a good wife. She stretched for a moment before grabbing her robe and heading downstairs. Coffee. She needed coffee. Strong, lovely American coffee. She filled a mug from the machine in the kitchen and then followed the trail of noise to Billy's office. Her nose crinkled as she passed several large vases filled with pungent flowers, a cacophony of color and scent filling the hallway that gave her a wave of cloying nausea. "Jesus, Billy," she said, as she drifted into his office and went to kiss him dutifully on the cheek. "Where did all those awful flowers come from?"
"Morning, honey."
He was leaning against his desk, face red from the treadmill, a carton of coconut water in hand. She should be glad he was making an effort. But the sight of him in his sportswear, so pleased with himself, made her want to cringe. Youth was for the young. His was gone. No matter how often he got on the treadmill, he couldn't run from old age and death. He'd be better off making his peace with it.
"Oh, I'm sorry."
The voice came from behind her. Elizabeth, sitting demurely on the leather couch, notebook and diary open on the coffee table.
"It's habit. I used to get them for Eleanor every few days. She loved all the perfumes. I did it without thinking." "Oh, no, I'm sorry," Keisha said, feeling entirely not sorry.
There was a brief glint in the secretary's eye that made Keisha wonder if the flowers had been bought to remind her once again that she was simply a poor replacement.
"Of course, Eleanor."
She spoke the last words softly, the dead wife who wouldn't be laid to rest.
"I'll get Zelda to throw them out."
William squeezed her waist and she gave him her sweetest smile.
"Only if that's okay."
She leaned in, pressing her body against his. Think of the money, the big prize, the inheritance. All those voices in her head, hers only one among those of others she knew, family, friends, lover.
"I know it's hard for you."
William took another sip of his drink.
"No more flowers unless you've chosen them."
He paused.
"And I'll have that portrait taken down too. You shouldn't have to look at that every day. This is your home now."
"Thank you."
She kissed him again, this time on the lips. Was he having the portrait taken down for her or for him? Did he feel guilty that he'd moved on so quickly? Either way, it didn't matter. She knew men. She'd seen enough at the club. Out of sight was out of mind. Whatever his lingering feelings were for his first wife, they'd vanish with the painting. Maybe that's why all the photos of Lyle were hidden away too. Men weren't very good at feeling, was what she'd learned in life. It was too hard, too real. She was the opposite. Sometimes she was sure she would be overwhelmed by real.
I'll get it put in storage.
Elizabeth scribbled herself a note.
And I'll speak to the kitchen designer about that faulty drawer. I have no idea how things are falling down the back into the space there, but maybe you don't keep your glass as a passport in there anymore.
Thanks.
William turned to Keisha.
Will you be okay if I go into the office for a couple of hours?
William said.
I've got to start your green card paperwork, and there's no point paying another lawyer to do it when I have a firm of them.
Of course, I'll be fine. Take as long as you need.
I also want to get a new life insurance policy and make some changes to my will.
His eyes shone. Today he was in a good mood, her adoring puppy, not an old dog baring its teeth.
Now I'd better go shower and change.
Elizabeth took that as her cue to disappear and leave them alone.
You sure you'll be okay?
Keisha smiled. I'm a grown-up. I'll be fine. Why don't I meet you somewhere for lunch when you're done?
That's a great idea.
Hey, why don't you ask Jason and Marcy to join us?
The question was light, as if a momentary afterthought.
I should get to know them better.
He held her tight, and she didn't flinch from the cooling sweat and the gray hairs of his barrel chest as they rubbed on her skin. Life insurance. Will. She luxuriated in those words instead, using them to build a hard shell around herself.
Good idea.
He kissed the top of her head.
I'll speak to Jason and let you know where to meet us.
It's a plan. Now shower, go.
She pushed him playfully away. It was a plan. 4 months of Billy had left her aching for something else, something for her heart. And there was no crime in looking. She waited impatiently for William to dress and leave. A few hours to herself would be blissful. She'd take a Valium, keep the demons in her head quiet, play loud music, and have an hour-long bath to relax. First, though, once he was finally gone, she found herself back in Eleanor's room, carefully picking through the dead woman's jewelry boxes. She wasn't going to take anything, but she wanted to see if the pieces Billy had thus far given her, expensive as they were not just trinkets in comparison. How was her worth measuring up?
Are you looking for something, ma'am?
Keisha nearly dropped the string of pearls she was examining.
Jesus shit, Zelda, you made me jump.
I'm sorry, ma'am. I didn't know that Mr. Radford was happy for people to come in here yet. I must have been wrong.
Keisha looked at the diminutive black woman in the doorway. There had been definite disapproval in her tone, a slight distaste in her expression. Keisha's hackles rose. There were too many people controlling her life. There always had been. She wouldn't take it from a housekeeper. Who was she to judge?
Billy won't mind, Keisha said, breezing out of the room. We're only waiting for Iris to get back from vacation. Then this will all be sorted and cleared out.
She paused and looked down at the housekeeper. Why was she even explaining herself?
Anyway, it's my house now. I can go where I want.
Yes, ma'am, Zelda said.
I'd like some tea, English style, and bring it to my bathroom.
She didn't even want any tea, but she did want to be respected. No one had respected her at home. That wasn't going to happen here. Zelda was going to have to change her tune, or Billy would be looking for new staff. She ran the hot water, swallowed a Valium, and tried to shake off her irritation, even managing a thank you when the drink arrived. Lunch, she thought, as she slid naked into the vast bath, submerging herself in the bubbles. Relax and think about lunch. 8. In Southside, it always felt 10 degrees hotter to Marcy, and her hands were slick with sweat in her plastic gloves, but there was no way she was going to take them off. The community center that served as the mission soup kitchen stank of stale summer sweat and the thick, meaty stench of the paper mills,
as if any breeze that passed over the city dragged it here, where it could settle away from the polite squares and strollers in Forsyth Park. There were worse smells, too, ones that emanated from the warm bodies, and there was no way she was going to touch any of the shuffling line of homeless degenerates lining up for stew and dumplings and a beaker of cherry Kool-Aid. Unlike the other volunteers who chatted together, Marcy kept herself to herself. They were all fully paid-up Baptists, and she didn't want to get absorbed into the inner congregation by accident. Another set. Savannah was full of sets. Out among the tables, Virginia was in her element, touching shoulders, relishing the gratitude. It was different for Virginia. She'd never been poor. For all the time she spent here, these people weren't real. She didn't see them as whole, good, bad, ugly, or somewhere in between. They were simply unfortunate, as if none had ever been part of his or her own downfall. Marcy didn't like being around the homeless, but at least she didn't diminish them. She glanced down the line to where an old man, Harold, was slowly moving forward. His face was a portrait of etched unpleasantness, and although she never acknowledged it, she was aware that his free hand went down to the crotch of his pants whenever he looked at her, a move designed to make her feel uncomfortable, a way to take a little power back. She slopped the stew over the side of the bowl, spilling some on him. "Oops, silly me."
"Dumb bitch," he muttered.
"It's not me who's going to die on a street corner one day, stinking of my own piss, though, is it?" she wanted to hiss back. Instead, she handed him a biscuit as they glared at each other.
"Over here, Harold," Virginia called. "Lawrence saved a seat for you."
Lawrence and Harold, the most ridiculous names for two old drunks, if those were their names at all. It's not like anyone here checked IDs. Crude and foul, though, both of them. The worst of the clients, as Virginia insisted the tramps be called. Jason couldn't understand why she always went back. Whenever she'd come home from helping, she would bitch about Harold this or Lawrence that. How could she explain it to him? She wasn't here just to cozy up to Virginia or fill a few hours with something after that embarrassing failure of her boutique. It ran deeper than that. She liked to remind herself of how life could turn on a dime. One bad deal at work, one divorce, a couple too many drinks. And then you're sleeping in a square all day with everything you love in a brown paper bag. Life changed, and it could change fast. It never hurt to remember that. These raggedy shells of humanity disgusted her on a visceral level, but she needed her disgust. Jason would never understand that. Sure, he'd had problems with his father, but he'd never been poor in his bones. He'd come from the right blood, and the right blood rallied around and helped pick him back up when Maddox Sr. had done the honorable thing in his disgrace and killed himself. She caught herself. That was blunt, even for her. Everything was setting her on edge. She felt claustrophobic. The plastic gloves on her hands felt too tight, suffocating her skin. The weight of this life, one she'd done so much to secure for herself, had at some point settled around her neck like a noose. Jason. She was embarrassed by her behavior of the day before. It wasn't like her to either feel so weak or show weakness like that, to allow the jealous paranoias of a younger woman. She cringed when she thought about it. Maybe she'd go and surprise him. Yes, that's what she'd do. Take him somewhere lovely for lunch, somewhere decadent and not like this. Try and get some of the good of their relationship back. As soon as her shift was done, she freshened up in the staff-only restrooms and then rushed out to her car, eager for this rundown part of town to evaporate behind her, out of sight, out of mind. He was her husband, hers. Thoughts of this little bitch weren't going to sour that. She'd make it right. Keisha was no one. Jason might want her physically, but no matter who she was married to, Keisha didn't fit in, and she never would. As Marcy put the car in drive, she tried to ignore the quiet voice at the back of her mind that whispered, "But why would she ever want to?" "He never goes for lunch before 2:00. Marcy frowned, quietly fuming.
It was only 1:30, and there was no sign of Jason in his office. She'd tried his mobile, but it was going straight to voicemail. So much for her big romantic gesture. Where the hell was he?
He was with Mr. Radford,
Sandy, the partner's assistant, told her.
They left about 30 or 40 minutes ago, I guess.
Did he say where they were going?
No, just lunch. Did you try his cell?
It's been a bit glitchy, I can't get through. How stupid did Sandy think she was? Or was she enjoying seeing Marcy on the back foot? Damn you, Jason, for embarrassing me.
Oh, Elizabeth was here earlier, Sandy exclaimed. She probably made the reservation since I didn't. You could try her.
Back out in the heat, still annoyed and sweating, Marcy wondered if she should leave them to their boys' day. But after the morning with Virginia immersed in the grime of the city, she wanted to see Jason, to settle any choppy water beneath them. To feel like she belonged again, not a cuckoo in the nest like Keisha. And what else was she supposed to do? Go home and drink wine alone? She dialed.
Hey, Marcy!
Elizabeth's voice crackled, distant, as she answered. Still chirpy, though, ever chirpy. That was Elizabeth.
What can I do you for? You'll have to talk loud. I'm in the car, and this hands-free thing doesn't work so good.
Typical Elizabeth. Surely she could afford something better, or get William to pay for it. She probably didn't want to be a bother. Elizabeth survived in this luxury jungle of theirs by not being a bother.
I'm looking for Jason. Wanted to surprise him, but Sandy said he'd already gone for lunch.
Why did she feel so ridiculous asking? It's not like she normally knew where Jason was every minute of every day. It hardly screamed problem in marriage. In fact, if she did know where he was all the time, that would be more of an issue.